Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Mueller. And joining us by phone is Beth Dooley. She's the author of The Northern Heartland Kitchen, more than 200 recipes to satisfy seasonal appetites. Beth is a restaurant critic for Minneapolis-St. Paul magazine. She also writes for the taste section of the Minneapolis and St. Paul Star Tribune. She teaches cooking classes at the University of Minnesota Landscape Arboretum, and she is joining us from her home in Minneapolis. Thanks so much for joining us today, Beth.
Oh, thanks for having me on. This is great.
Well, and I have to say, there was a real chill in the air this morning in Madison, and I'm guessing in other parts of the state and probably in Minnesota, too. So
yes. It
seems like thinking about what grows here and what are particularly tasty dishes for this time of year is just appropriate. And of course, we're exactly 1 week out from Thanksgiving. And I think if there's any holiday where we really focus on the regional and seasonal, it's Thanksgiving.
That's so true. And there's something about those temperatures plunging that just make us hungry, I think. So
we were having a talk about that here the other day, and everyone felt at least relieved that they weren't the only one that seemed to be, you know, trying to stockpile things internally for winter.
It's so true. The other nice thing about this time of year, too, is that I don't know about you, but when I get towards the end of the harvest season, I'm both exhausted and kind of in a panic trying to eat everything out of the garden as quickly as I can,
right,
or to put it up and you know, preserve it for the rest of the year. Now we can just step back and relax because those hardy root crops store really beautifully, and the pumpkins and squash can kind of sit, you know, in a cool, dark place until we're ready to use them. The same thing with potatoes. So we're under less pressure, I think.
Exactly.
And that's kind of a relief as well. We can just kind of relax and enjoy being inside out of the cold.
And so, Beth, why is it important for you personally to focus on seasonal and local ingredients in your recipes?
Well, there are a couple of reasons. The first one is that the food simply tastes better if it comes from nearby. It's more nutritious because it hasn't traveled millions of miles from far away. And, you know, then there are a lot of other reasons that I consider just as important. First of all, the small farmers that are the local farmers are using sustainable practices which actually improve the land, water, and air. And I like knowing them. I like knowing what they're doing. I like connecting with those farmers because it really gives me a sense of place. And I also think when we cook within the seasons, we're paying attention to really what's going on around us. It's another way to really stay connected to your life. You know, and that may sound sort of precious, but it's not. Because in going to the farmers markets and in cooking out of my CSA box, I've come to know the area at a much deeper level. I grew up in New Jersey, actually, and I lived there and covered the zoning board for the Princeton Packet, which was the small newspaper that covered the area right outside Princeton, New Jersey, which at that time was being converted from farmland into development. And I witnessed the demise of these beautiful small farms that all had farm stands and served farmers markets to the point that there was no local food left in that area. Everything was coming in from far away. When we moved to Minnesota, I was struck by how much farmland there still is, by how vibrant the farmers markets are, by how interesting the farmers themselves are, and how much I could learn as a cook by connecting with them. And in doing that work, it really helped me make this place a home.
And I think one of the interesting developments that I've noticed around here is year-round farmers markets. So obviously not outdoors in December, January, February, but they're certainly smaller scale, but there are more and more weekly indoor markets during the winter for those kinds of products that you were talking about that keep better, or things like jams and jellies or meats and cheeses. And so, you know, it used to be a really seasonal thing that you could go to a farmers market, and happily now that's stretched through more seasons, too.
That's exactly right. And we have some wonderful producers who are doing some really fabulous things. I mean, some of the butters that are available to us now that are local taste so good. They rival anything that's being flown in from France or from Vermont. A lot of our cheeses, our meat, you know, we've got this wonderful grass-fed and pastured meat and beef and pork and pastured chicken and these beautiful eggs. So the ingredients that we have available at our fingertips are just remarkable, I think. Yeah.
And I want to make sure that our listeners can join in the conversation, too. Do you try to eat seasonally or regionally? What does that mean for you?
Yeah, I do. And I think there's a lot of confusion around what eating local means. I kind of shy away from this arbitrary, you know, you have to eat within a 50-mile or 100-mile radius. The term now used by a lot of researchers is trying to eat within a food shed, which means within a region. And our region, really, the northern heartland, is quite different than the southern Midwest. We're really the northern tier of the Midwest. And our area includes Wisconsin, Minnesota, parts of eastern North Dakota, and northern Iowa, and into western Michigan. And it's defined by the weather, by what grows here, you know, where our fertility is, and by the ethnic populations that have settled here. And those all really influence our cuisine, really our northern heartland cuisine. And, you know, it means just being mindful of where your food is coming from. So when you're presented with a lamb chop from Iowa instead of one from, you know, you would choose one from Iowa instead of one from New Zealand, for instance, or a Honeycrisp apple over one that's flown in from Washington. It's simply being more conscious of where your food is coming from. And I think that's what people are interested in knowing these days, and those are the kinds of conversations I think we're having right now, is simply being mindful of where our food's coming from. There's I know a lot of the co-ops in your area and in our area often run these local food challenges. And one of the co-ops recently moved all of their citrus fruit and bananas to the back of the produce department and put all the apples and the potatoes and the squashes up front. And they noticed a remarkable change in how much more local food people were buying. So a lot of it has to do with how things are merchandised, and that, I think, is up to us as cooks and eaters to begin to start using our power to leverage those kinds of changes.
1-800-642-1234 is the phone number, 800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. Our producer today is Amanda Magnus. She will get your calls on the air and your emails in to us. Beth, you were just talking about locally sourced ingredients that tend to be kind of the main part of a meal, like the meat or, say, potato. But you also talk about things like fat or sweeteners or seasonings that are more locally sourced. And I think that often, you know, we don't think of those quite as much as the others. What are some of those regional options?
You know, I'm really glad you asked, because sorghum is coming back, and a number of the growers down in southern Minnesota and northern Iowa, and my guess would be pretty soon in southern Wisconsin as well, are raising sorghum for sorghum syrup. And it's lovely. It's lighter than molasses, but it does sort of have molasses overtones, and it's great in gingerbreads and ginger cakes and cookies.
Hmm.
We're seeing more maple syrup and maple sugar, which is a wonderful sweetener. And then we're seeing some reduced fruit syrups, like apple syrup can be reduced to make a sweetener. So we're seeing more of those, which I think is really interesting. Other things that are coming on are chestnuts. The American chestnut, thanks to the work of several researchers, is coming back. They're using a back cross. I'm not sure I really quite understand it, but the American chestnut was wiped out back at the middle of the 1900s by blight, and it devastated forests all across the country, mostly on the East Coast, but we did have some standing chestnut forests down in southern Minnesota, northern Iowa, and in the center of Wisconsin near La Crosse. And the researchers have now come up with a way to hybridize them such that the blight resistance is bred into the American chestnut, and their trees are absolutely majestic. They can grow to as high as 90 feet. They're very productive, and chestnuts are wonderful. I mean, they're a wonderful source of protein. They're almost, when they're fresh, they're almost sweet. They're easy mm-hmm. to work with, and they're lovely in cakes and pies, and of course, stuffing is probably what we know them best for, as well as roasted
right.
chestnuts. Yes.
Well, and actually, that's a great lead into the fact that, as we said, Thanksgiving is a week from today.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there are some, I think, traditional expected dishes that there'd be a lot of grumbling around the table if they weren't there. What are some of those recipes that you have in the book? And I want to let people know we did post some recipes from the book and also from the book that we're going to be talking about in the second half, too, on our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mueller Show on Facebook. And there are a bunch of recipes there. So what are some of the traditional dishes that you can, you know, really make regional and seasonal?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. Cranberries, of course, are an iconic Wisconsin fruit, and the harvest is over now. They're so fresh and they're so delicious. And Wisconsin is the largest cranberry grower in the world. And there are several recipes here that I serve every year. One is a cranberry sorbet.
Mm.
Another one is a cranberry tart in a cornmeal crust. And it's a local corn. You know, if you look for local cornmeal, it makes a really nice crust. Another one is a savory cranberry compote. I know we're very used to having cranberries as kind of a sweet relish, but the savory compote include shallots and onions and a little bit of sage, and so it's a nice, not as sweet companion to turkey. And then of course there's always fresh cranberry relish and wild rice cranberry pilaf. The mashed potatoes, you know, again, there's nothing better than the potatoes that have just been harvested this fall. They really are quite different than the storage potatoes. They tend to be a little denser and they tend to have more potato flavor. So if you're using fresh local potatoes, you're going to get a really nice, fluffy, flavorful mashed potato that probably won't need as much cream or butter to give it that richness.
Although the cream and butter is awfully tasty.
It's awfully tasty. It is. It's awfully tasty. I mean, don't leave it out.
Yeah, right. Well, and actually, one of the things that I wanted to mention, since butter has come up a couple times, I think an overlooked way to give a usual dish a little different taste is by using compound butters. And you have quite a few in the book. We do have the blue cheese compound butter up on the Facebook note because you have that going along with bison steaks.
Yeah.
What are some of your favorite compound butters? And just explain a little what that means.
Well, you take an unsalted butter and you whip ingredients into it and then shape it into a log, roll it in parchment paper, and then just put it in the refrigerator. And then you can slice it and use it like you would any butter, but it's got that extra flavor. So, for instance, the blue cheese butter actually would be delicious on mashed potatoes, for instance. You could serve that on the side. Or a maple pecan butter would be really nice with cranberry muffins, or with any of the plain rolls that you might have that you'd serve on the Thanksgiving table. The other nice thing, too, about this compound butter is if you're using an herb compound butter, for instance, you could rub that on the turkey before it goes into the oven, and that will give it the nice sort of herbal mm-hmm. notes that you're looking for without having to stuff turkey. You know, you could stuff
right.
that compound butter, rub it underneath the skin, and then that'll infuse the turkey with a little bit of the herbs that you're using in the butter.
You can also, actually, this is something that I discovered a couple of years ago, you can melt the butter or compound butter or regular butter with a few herbs. And if you soak a single-layer cheesecloth in it and then drape that over the turkey, it actually keeps it on the skin instead of it, you know, more or less rolling right off.
Yeah.
And then you can keep basting that single layer of cheesecloth and it just stays a little longer on the skin.
That's a great idea. I think that's a great idea. Yeah, yeah. And one of the things people need to be aware of is when they're buying free-range or pastured turkeys, for instance, they do tend to cook a little differently than do the commercial brands that have been, you know, shot with flavorings and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And basting it and doing what you just described is a really good way to keep them moist.
We're talking with Beth Dooley, the author of The Northern Heartland Kitchen, more than 200 recipes to satisfy seasonal appetites. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Mueller. We're talking with Beth Dooley, the author of The Northern Heartland Kitchen, more than 200 recipes to satisfy seasonal appetites. And Beth, we talked a little bit about some of the traditional Thanksgiving side dishes and main courses, but What about some fun side dishes that might be a little different, but still appeal to a wide variety of tastes? Because I think that's one of the wonderful things and the challenging things about those big group meals is, you know, there's the uncle who really doesn't like anything that was ever green in its life. And then, you know, there are picky kids, perhaps, or picky adults, or, you know, people with different dietary needs. And actually, I want to let people know that I hope everyone will stay tuned, because at 11:45, we're going to talk with Erin McKenna from Baby Cakes NYC about vegan gluten-free baking. Yes, it is possible, and it can actually be quite delicious. So we'll cover some of those dietary needs on the dessert table, especially later. But what are some fun side dishes that people might not necessarily think of?
Yeah, well, you know, again, I'm glad you asked, because that's always the challenge for the cook. You don't want to keep repeating everything year after year, although there's some things that people will freak out if you don't serve.
Right.
You know, I love to roast vegetables, and Brussels sprouts become a whole different animal when you roast them. They caramelize, and they're nice and nutty brown. And I like to toss them with just a couple of tablespoons of either the sunflower oil or hazelnut oil, which sort of increases that nuttiness. Mm. And then sprinkle them with a little salt and throw some whole cloves of garlic in there, and then roast them in the oven and just shake the pan. Roast them in a hot oven for about, set the oven to about 400 and then roast them for, about 15 to 20 minutes until they're really nice, nutty brown. And then hit them with a little bit of either lemon juice or orange juice right when they come out.
Mm.
And it's so simple and it's so quick. And it will keep you, you know, in the kitchen fussing, but they'll, and actually they can be done just a little bit ahead because they're fine served at room temperature. I think that's the other thing that, you know, as I get older, I don't want to be rushing everything out that has to be served piping hot.
Right.
Because it's impossible when you have a large group to get everyone either to the buffet line or seated down all at the same time. So,
It's hard to just find room in the oven for all the things at the same time, too.
Exactly. It's nice to have a few things that you can kind of whip up ahead and just have ready to go. Another thing I like to do is a wild rice pilaf that has cranberries in it and some roasted chestnuts as well. And you just toss that with, and that's more of a salad. It's tossed with a little bit of a honey mustard vinaigrette. And it's wild rice and some chopped vegetables and some roasted chestnuts and then cranberries that have been quickly cooked with just a little bit of sugar, and it makes a really nice side dish. So there are things like that you can kind of toss together either the night before and then serve. And, you know, when we're talking about roasting, another fun thing to roast is broccoli and cauliflower. And again, they become so different when they're roasted. They don't get that soggy, kind of swampy flavor. They turn sort of nutty, caramelized mm-hmm. brown. And so those are not, you could do a combination of Brussels sprouts and broccoli and cauliflower. It'd be very pretty because they get that nice sort of caramelized color and flavor, and spark them up with a little bit of lemon juice, and they're great. And again, those things taste just fine served at room temperature.
I've done roasted cauliflower with a honey mustard kind of mix, and that really brings out that depth of the caramelization.
Yeah.
And since we're talking about things, you know, needing to do things quickly, or at least have some things that don't take as long as other things, especially for a big holiday meal, some of the things that we put up on the Facebook page, the note with recipes for today's show, you have 5 fall dishes in 5 minutes or less. And we put those up: autumn garden slaw, fresh apple and sage sauce, roast pears, spiced roast carrots. Carrots, another thing that roast really well, and grilled radicchio. Radicchio being those small, pretty tight heads of that reddish, almost purpley green. And all of those are really fast. So a great option for cooks that don't have a lot of oven space or time, or have, you know, 6 different dishes they're trying to finish off.
Right, exactly. And that's one of the other things about using local foods is that they taste better. So you really don't need to do a lot to them. You know, there's a honey, ginger, pumpkin pie in the autumn chapter of this book. And it was really a surprise because I used fresh ginger. Some of the growers down in southern Wisconsin and southern Minnesota are actually growing ginger. And it's delicious because it's so fresh and almost sweet. And if you can find a good fresh ginger and use it, and you're using a local Cinderella pumpkin or a pie pumpkin, which tend to be really dense and sweet. They're cute little pumpkins. And use those for the pie with just a little bit of really nice local cream. you can taste the pumpkin. You're not just tasting all of the spices. So I think that's part of it, too, and that's what inspired the five fall dishes in 5 minutes or less, is just this desire to get something out there quickly and not to mess those natural flavors up too much, just to, you know, kind of play with them a little bit, but let them shine through.
Mary in Whitewater has a question for you, Beth, so let's go to the phone. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I was invited to a Thanksgiving dinner by someone else, and I don't know what they're going to serve, but I told them that I would bring something. I would make something from something I grew in my garden, and I grow delicata squash and purple cabbage and shallots.
Oh, nice.
And I'm not so sure that the purple cabbage would go over on Thanksgiving, but I know that the delicata squash is more traditional, and I know it's just so good by itself, and I don't want to really mask the flavor with a lot of spices and nutmeg and things like that. And I was wondering if you might have suggestions for some way to maybe to prepare either one of those that I could do it the day before and then reheat it before I leave.
You know what I would do?
Uh-huh.
Is that delicata squash is so lovely. It's so sweet. And again, I mean, my easy out is roasting. And so I think what I might do is peel the squash and cube it and toss it with a little bit of oil, either as, again, I like either the local sunflower oils or a nut oil, like a hazelnut or a walnut oil, with just a little bit enough to coat it, and sprinkle it with a little bit of salt, and then spread it out so that the pieces are not touching on a cookie sheet, and roast it high heat at about 400 degrees.
At 400?
And sort of turn it once in a while and shake the pan so that it doesn't stick, and so that all sides of that squash get kind of a nice caramelized brown. If the pieces are about 1 to 2 inches, it'll probably take you about 15 to 20 minutes to roast them that way. And you can actually do that ahead, and then I would throw that into, you could do two things. You could either use it as a salad and present it on, you could shred your red cabbage and present the squash on shredded red cabbage that had been tossed with, say, a honey mustard vinaigrette or a maple mustard vinaigrette, and drizzle a little bit of that dressing over the roasted squash as well. Or you could toss the roasted squash with a little bit of cooked wild rice as kind of a pilaf, and then just finish it again with just a little salt and pepper or a little butter or something like that.
Uh-huh.
So it sounds good.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks, Mary. It sounds really good.
Yeah.
I'm sure that the people that invited you will invite you back again. let's go to Terry in Blue Mounds next.
Hi, Terry.
Oops, there we go.
Hi. I wanted to just make a comment about compound butters.
Yes.
I grow a lot of herbs, and so I'm always mixing them into my butters. And I came up with one last year that I absolutely love, and I mixed butter with lavender.
Oh, yum.
And, that all started because I'd had rose butter once, and I thought, well, surely, you know, I should be able to make something besides rose butter. And so I just really pulverized the lavender and then mixed it in with the butter, and it's great on crepes, but it's also really good, like, if you put a little butter in a pan and you have leftover roast ham after Christmas and you fry it in that, it just gives it a little sweetness, and it's really nice.
That sounds delicious. And, you know, lavender in France, they often finish like a grilled piece of meat with a little bit of lavender.
Yes.
So I can see like a little pat of butter on, say, a grilled ribeye or something like that. That would be lovely.
Mm-hmm. Or lavender and blue cheese go really well together.
Ooh, that sounds really good.
Yeah.
Yum.
Well, and I've had lavender shortbread cookies, too, so the fact that it goes well with butter isn't surprising.
Right.
Yeah, I bet it's pretty, too. I bet it's really pretty.
Yeah.
Those would make nice gifts, too, little like rolls of lavender butter or something.
Oh, yeah.
Really pretty. Yeah.
Great.
A nice idea.
Thanks for that idea, Terry.
Sure, no problem.
Sounds delicious.
Thank you.
And so, Beth, we have talked about game a little bit, including you talk about deer and rabbit and pheasant in the book. What's important to know about those meats, and what recipes do you find go well with them?
Yeah, pheasant is such a delicate meat, and it dries out so easily. And I'm not a hunter myself, so I rely on the bounty of friends that want to give me their pheasant and duck. With pheasant, I've actually found that brining it sometimes is the way to go. And I just do a very simple brine that has enough salt in it to float an egg. It's maybe about 2 or 3 cups of water to about a half a cup of salt, and then I throw about 1/4 cup of sugar in with that and stir them until it's all melted, and throw a couple of sage leaves in with that, and then soak the pheasant breast overnight in the brine, pull it out, rinse it off, and then with pheasant, again, because you want to bard it, I often will wrap the pheasant in, if I'm going to pan fry it or even grill it, I'll wrap it in a good bacon and then cook it in the bacon, and that infuses it with that nice smoky flavor, but it doesn't overpower the meat if you just use one strip. The other thing that I've learned from other good game cooks is to saute the, to flour the meat, both the dark meat and the breast of the pheasant, to flour it lightly, pan fry it, and then put it in a casserole dish and cover it with some stock and a little bit of hard cider and apple cider and just a little bit of cream, and then cover it and bake it that way on a low heat. So, again, it's such a lean meat that it either needs to be cooked very quickly and served right away, or cooked slowly with low heat. With duck, because duck can be so fatty, I learned from a couple of restaurant chefs that the thing to do is just prick it lightly before you put it in the oven. Prick it so that the you're just pricking the top part of the skin, and that will release the fat from that top part of the that layer of fat, so that the duck self-bastes and roast it as you would a chicken in a 350-degree oven, and you'll end up with a nice, tender duck that way. And with most game, because the game is, especially duck and goose and venison, they're rich enough, flavorful meats, that it's nice to balance them with something that's a little sweet and tart. So apples and cranberries and pears go beautifully. They pair beautifully with that kind of a meat.
That sounds really good. And I think that, you know, this being a big game time of year, it's nice to think about that. And, you know, there are a lot of folks that are going to be out hunting, especially starting this weekend with the deer hunt going on. Have you actually made game for holiday meals? Is it something you can do for large groups easily?
You can. You just want to be mindful that that you don't dry things out. I think that's always the biggest worry when you're cooking, especially the game birds. I know my kids love to have goose at Christmas. I think it's because they read about it in some of the old...
I think that might be in A Christmas Carol,
yeah,
isn't it?
exactly. And, you know, all those sorts of traditional foods are great. And with goose, it's the same as duck. You just want to be careful that you're treating the fat so that the fat base the bird. And with goose, again, you want to... With goose, even more than duck, because they're not quite as fatty, you want to roast it a little lower and a little slower, and be careful not to dry it out. And just baste like crazy is what I usually do. Just keep basting it and basting it. And basting
when in doubt, and baste again.
Exactly. But yeah, game is great this time of year. I think we're hungry for it as well.
I think so too. Like you said, with the colder weather and the shorter days, we definitely tend towards more hearty foods, I think.
Yeah. The other thing is, I have a number of hunters who are friends that use the venison that they don't eat in mincemeat, and that's a great way to work with venison, is to use it in any of the old mincemeat recipes instead of beef, because some parts of the deer are really quite tough, and so by chopping them up in a Cuisinart, for instance, and then using them with the spices and the raisins and
the liquor.
The liquor, exactly. Yeah, it's delicious, and it's great. You know, then you've got sort of a sweet, savory pie
right. That
you can serve either for dessert, or you can serve, you can have it for, on game day.
Sounds great. We have Alex and Warren with a question for you.
Hi,
Let's
Alex.
Let's go to Alex.
Just wanted to ask, me and my family, we really like cheese a lot. And I was wondering, is there some kind of Thanksgiving recipe maybe I can try that involves lots of cheese in it?
Yeah. You know, you could... Do you like Chev? Do you like goat cheese, or is it more cheddar? Do you have, what kind of cheeses do you like?
More Munster, cheddar, Guada, kind of those kind of cheeses more.
Yeah, yeah. You could do a really nice potato gratin, you know, along with your mashed potatoes. If you wanted to do a second potato dish, you could do a potato gratin and use different kinds of potatoes so that you had different colors. But in that dish, the potatoes are cooked with a little bit of cream and a lot of cheese. And I've got a nice potato gratin recipe in my book, but there are lots of them out there if you want to use another cookbook. So that would be something nice to do. The other thing you could do is make a gougère, which is just it's like a puff pastry that's got cheese whipped into it. That's it's an appetizer that's baked. Another thing to do is to do bruschetta, which, you know, you're just taking bread and kind of toasting it lightly, slicing it like a baguette, slice it lightly and brush it with a little bit of olive oil, and then put a cheese that you like on top of it and blast it in the oven until the cheese melts. So you have like a nice sort of bubbly, cheesy, crusty, you know, little toast, and then top it with a little bit of a cranberry compote or cranberry conserve that you like. I've got one in Northern Heartland Kitchen that uses ginger. So you could put a little fresh cranberry compote on top of the melted cheese crostata or bruschetta and serve it as an appetizer.
That sounds great. Thank you.
Yeah, you bet.
Hey, thanks for calling, Alex. That all sounds very good. And I want to put actually my vote in for gougère, the little puff pastries with cheese in them. And it's cheese in the batter. I want people to understand it's not like it's stuffed on the inside, right. But they are really wonderful and not that hard to make, actually.
They're not that hard to make, and you really wow people when
it's
you make
true. Yeah. It's true. They're quite the crowd pleaser.
They are. That's my kind of cooking, you know.
We have Cynthia in Madison next. Hi, Cynthia.
Hi, Cynthia.
Hi. I just want to say thanks for the show. I am starving now. And we did our first CSA this summer, and it was wonderful. But my question is, I'm married to a wonderful man who is unfortunately lactose intolerant, and I've wanted to do things with, like, herbed butter. Is it better to do, I mean, can you do that with, like, margarine, or is it better to do it with oil?
You know, you can do two things. You can certainly do it with oil. You can infuse herbs with oil, and that's not hard to do. What you want to be careful, though, is to store the oil in the refrigerator, because there, no matter how hard you try, there's usually some bacteria on the herbs. And for some reason, it doesn't seem to. It seems okay with butter, but not with oil. And so you don't want to leave that oil out on the counter. So, but you could infuse herbs into the oil. The other thing you could do is, you know, when you're thinking of the compound butter, so you're thinking of something, or a compound spread, are you thinking of something that he could either dip the bread into or spread on bread?
And then also, I guess, you know, to in mashed potatoes, you know,
right.
We usually have to make those with soy milk.
Right.
But, you know, different things like that, or even on steaks.
Yeah. You know what I would do in that case is use soy milk, and also I think almond milk is nice too. And then use a little bit of oil, and the local sunflower oils that I know you have, I'm sure you've got them in those areas. Dripless Organic makes a beautiful one, and it's got a lovely, it's golden color, and it's got a lovely sort of nutty taste. And so if you were to mash, say, Yukon Gold potatoes, which have that pretty kind of golden flesh for your mashed potatoes, and use when I would peel them and boil them and then not dump all of the water out. So when you're mashing them, you're using a little bit of the potato water to mash them in, not a lot, but just enough to kind of, you know, to make them moist. And then I would drizzle in some of the sunflower oil as you're mashing, and then the herbs that you like. And it could be chopped rosemary or thyme would be wonderful, and a little salt and pepper. And you may find out that you don't even need either the soy milk or the almond milk to get that rich consistency, because those potatoes are quite moist. Well, you want to be careful not to overmash them so they don't get gluey. But you can. The other thing to do would be to make kind of a vegetable mashed root vegetable that included parsnips and maybe some rutabaga in with the mashed potatoes, and that'll give it a little more flavor. And then add your oil and your herbs to that. And if you throw some of your herbs into the pot while the potatoes are cooking, they'll absorb some of that herb flavor as well. The other thing you could do is some of the spreads, the non-dairy spreads have gotten so much better. You could beat some of the herbs into one of those spreads, too, if you wanted something on the table that you could spread on bread.
That sounds great. Thank you. There's kind of nothing grosser than soy milk in your mashed potatoes. So, enjoy them, but I don't.
Yeah, I guess, my advice would be to try mashing them without the milk unless you really need it.
Mm-hmm.
And see how far you can go with that, because those fresh Yukon Gold potatoes have a marvelous flavor.
Okay. Yeah, great. Thank you.
Yeah, you bet.
Thanks, Cynthia. And actually, you just brought up a couple vegetables, Beth, that I think often get short shrift. Parsnips, turnips, and rutabagas, I think, are sometimes thought of as the things you eat if there's nothing else around. But they're great.
They're fabulous.
Are great for roasting, too.
They're wonderful for roasting. And I like roasting them and then tossing them with, I've got a horseradish honey vinaigrette, which is both sweet and snappy, and it seems to work really well with those kinds of roots because, as you said, when you roast them, they become earthier and a little bit sweeter, and they have this lovely kind of nutty flavor to them, and they get real tender and almost silky, and they're just delicious. You can even get kids to eat them that way.
And coincidentally, the horseradish and honey-glazed root vegetables is one of the recipes that I put up because it sounded so good to me.
Excellent. Oh, that's great.
Well, and horseradish, actually, this is the first year that I grew horseradish in my garden, actually in a container because a couple of my neighbors have black walnut trees, so anything I actually want to thrive pretty much has to be in a container. And so I'm actually waiting. I'm going to dig out my horseradish root and grate it soon. So,
good for you.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to trying that. And I think it's Virgin Voyage might be the honey glazed root vegetables.
Oh, wonderful. That's great.
Well, we've been talking with Beth Dooley, the author of The Northern Heartland Kitchen, more than 200 recipes to satisfy seasonal appetites. Beth's also a restaurant critic up in the Twin Cities area. She teaches cooking classes at the University of Minnesota Landscape Arboretum, and she's been talking to us from her home in Minneapolis. And Beth, it's just been a real pleasure, and the caller that said she was getting hungry is not the only one, because everything has sounded really great.
Oh, I'm so glad. Thank you so much. This has been such a pleasure.
Thanks so much, and have a nice Thanksgiving. I'm sure whoever you're cooking for will have a wonderful day.
Oh, thank you, too. Thanks.
That was Beth Dooley, author of The Northern Heartland Kitchen. We are going to switch over. We're going to stay in the kitchen, but we're going to switch over from regional seasonal cooking to baked goods that avoid many potential allergens but are still really delicious. Stay tuned for a fun and mouthwatering conversation with baking diva Erin McKenna here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.